Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's practice groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federalist Society virtual event. I'm Caroline Bryant, and I'm Associate Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host this webinar on insights on the National Spectrum Strategy. Our moderator today is the Honorable John Neuer. John is the president and founder of JKC Consulting, LLC. Prior to starting Neuer LLC, Mr. Neuer served as the Assistant Secretary of Commerce for Communications and Information. In this capacity, Mr. Neuer was the principal advisor to the President of the United States on telecommunications policy and the administrator of the National Telecommunications and Information Administration, or NTIA. If you'd like to learn more about today's moderator or speakers, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. After our speakers give their presentations, we will turn to you, the audience, for questions. If you have a question, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window, and we will do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speaker, not the Federalist Society. With that, John, thank you for joining us today, and the floor is yours.
Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining this most recent FedSoc, Federal Society webinar. Today, we're going to be talking about the National Spectrum Strategy. We've got a really ideal panel of experts, people who've been in the field working on this issue for, afraid to say decades, but we are all reached that phase and that it is now decades. This is a very interesting topic in the way it intersects our national security and our economic security. It involves cross-cutting issues of law and regulation, and it is focused on an input into the economy, the radio spectrum, which over the past decades has become sort of the foundational input to our modern economy. So lots of interesting stuff to get through. I wanted to take a second at the start and read from presidential report on spectrum that sort of laid this out. It starts, "In today's era of modern communications, radio frequency spectrum is critical. Just as steel, lumber, oil, and natural gas were key resources in the 20th century, spectrum is important in the 21st century. Current spectrum management policies for existing spectrum-based services continue to grow. Recognize this fact, the president has established the Spectrum Policy Initiative to promote the development and implementation of a U.S. spectrum policy for the 21st century." That is not the spectrum policy item that we're talking about today. That's from 20 years ago in the Bush administration, 2004. So the issues remain the same, but the challenge is having an opportunity to catch up with the technology as it advances, and the demand only increases, but the supply of the spectrum is finite. So that's what we're going to talk about today. We've got, like I said, a very esteemed panel. We've got Umair Javed, who had most recently been in the office of Chairwoman Rosenworcel at the FCC and is now at CTIA. Rob McDowell, another prestigious FCC alumni as a commissioner, who now works with a variety of different innovators and industry market participants. And then we're very lucky to have Jennifer Warren from Lockheed Martin, who has worked supporting government equities on this, and significantly, and I think we'll get to this during this conversation, Jennifer has been a tireless advocate in the international fora, the World Radio Conference, participating as an industry rep in the U.S. delegations going back for several conferences, and her input was always hugely valuable, and look forward to getting to all of that from each of you today. I wanted to start with you, Umair, if I could. You know, given that you've just recently come out of the FCC and you are now working with industry, how, if at all, has your perspective changed going from representing just the government equities or the broader public policy interests and now getting into the commercial side of things? Do you view things differently, or do you think there are things that you've learned being outside of government that you said, you know, maybe the government could be doing something different in this space?
Sure. And thank you, John. Great to be here and great to be here with Rob and Jennifer as well. Great question. And you're right. Before I joined CTIA, I was at the FCC where I worked on a lot of spectrum issues in both places. Let me start with maybe something that hasn't changed. In both places, I grounded my work in the belief that we are better off as more people connect. I believe that was true for the country when I was at FCC, and I believe it is true for our industry now that I'm at CTIA. So that part, I think, hasn't changed. I think what has evolved is when we took the chair's office back in 2020, there was a lot of focus on revitalizing the spectrum decision-making process in the United States. You know, in the years prior, the U.S. had faced this challenge of imagining how to promote wireless innovation in an increasingly congested spectrum environment. It's not easy, right? It's a hard thing to do. And there was progress, but there were some bumps in the road as well. And a lot of the consensus back then zeroed in on how the federal government was or was not coordinating its spectrum decisions. And so we all focused a lot on that question. How do we deliver real and effective coordination? How do we do it quickly? And it was that thinking that led to the new memorandum of understanding between FCC and NTIA, and that also helped lead ultimately to the National Spectrum Strategy. I still think today that focusing on process was important. But I think I increasingly believe that our ambition has to be bigger than that. We have to lead the world in wireless, not just manage our government. And so that's what I think about a lot, I think, since I've left the government. The other thing I've come to appreciate is that sometimes when you try to fix something, and I learned this doing a do-it-yourself home repair, actually, sometimes when you try to fix something, no matter how well-intentioned your efforts are, you can make it worse. Things can go wrong. And I think a lot about this article that was written back in 2018, actually, called Why Do Things Go Right? And it had nothing to do with spectrum. It was about hospital safety. And it was already well known that, you know, 1 in 13 patients were hurt in some way during their hospital stay. And the reasons were exactly what you would expect, right? It's staff would be taking shortcuts, they weren't following procedures strictly, or managers were not discharging their duties effectively. And this was leading to bad outcomes. So this paper, instead of re-looking at those 1 in 13 cases, it looked at the other 12. And it wanted to know, why were people having good outcomes at hospitals? And what they found was that the factors that led to successful outcomes were exactly the same factors that led to the 1 in 13 bad outcomes. It was, you know, good things were happening when staff was willing to take shortcuts when they needed to, when they were willing to deviate from strict procedures, when managers were willing to step back and listen and let their teams do the work. And so what I take away from this is that the same things that contributed to the bad outcomes also allowed the good outcomes. And we should think about that in spectrum policy as well. I think the Biden administration has given a lot of thought about how to remove the causes of controversial spectrum decisions through new processes. But I think we have to ask, could these new processes also inadvertently remove the causes of the good spectrum decisions and the things that were allowing actual spectrum action to occur? I think there is a way to solve for that risk. I think it's by setting clear goals, having a process that's coupled with a vision of where you want to be. And so that's what I focus a lot on these days.
Interesting. So Jennifer, let me turn to you on that, because I think at its core, what Umair is talking about is that spectrum policy decisions very often, almost always, involve a balancing of equities, whether it is two different commercial users, a commercial user and a government equity, competing technologies. And in the WARC and in some of the other international fora where, you know, we're trying to export, you know, some, not just our view of which bands should be authorized in which places, but oftentimes also a process solution, as Umair talks about. It seems that the process domestically right now is not in a great place in terms of conflict between government equities and commercial equities, between various government equities. How is that, in your experience or your view, playing out in the international arena? And how does that impact the U.S. multilateral diplomatic efforts to come up with a harmonized spectrum policy, you know, for the North American region and the world in general?
John, thanks a lot. And it is a pleasure to be on this. It's my friends who I've known for many years, and in the context of many years, since you raised it earlier, I have been at every World Radio Conference since 1995. So I'll just put it out there. You can do your own numbers. So I've been able to appreciate the increasing difficulties and challenges that arise in the context of trying to repurpose, harmonize spectrum, and how those international negotiations are complicated. So a couple of things, right? For those not as familiar with the ITU, one of its primary roles with respect to spectrum is to produce a set of international radio regulations that are updated every 4 years that minimizes, if not prevents, cross-border interference, right? That's a primary goal. Globally harmonized, for sure, and even regionally harmonized spectrum advances that goal. And for a lot of the economic interests, whether it's aviation, space, even the defense industrial base, most of the spectrum where our products and systems operate is already globally harmonized. So when the US and some other countries push for deharmonizing spectrum that's used for some of these global capabilities, it starts to put at risk the ability to fully utilize spectrum, because now you have less harmonization across borders, because not all nations now may follow one, they may follow a different option. The complication comes from when the US tries to export national decisions without giving the ITU and the member countries the tools to understand the terms and conditions under which the US has made its decisions. And my favorite example is CBRS, right? Because the United States has historically taken the position, we'll push for changes in the allocation table, but we won't export the terms and conditions under which it's a success. And when you look at the imbalance in resources, technical, human, et cetera, that exist at the FCC and NTIA versus most regulators globally, particularly in the global South, it's very hard for them to understand how the U.S. arrives at some of its national decisions and who the winners, losers are, what really is spectrum sharing, what really is coexistence. So that's been a huge challenge, John, in more lately, because we aren't able to explain what we're doing in terms of the technical T's and C's. And there are significant U.S. economic interests, whether it's the defense industrial base, as I said, aviation, commercial space, in addition to the MNOs, in addition to the cable industry, in addition to the Wi-Fi, because I like to make sure we think about all the sectors of telecom, not just one. So that's one of the big complications that I've seen.
So Rob, let me turn to you. I probably should have laid out as the background. Spectrum policymaking in the United States government flows through a number of different government entities and agencies. So NTIA, the National Telecommunication and Information Administration, where I served in the Bush administration, is ostensibly and under the statute supposed to be the forum by which all the other spectrum-dependent agencies inside the government that Jennifer just referencing, the Defense Department, NASA, EPA, basically every agency has spectrum needs, law enforcement, and their interests get coordinated at NTIA in a single process. And then that gets coordinated with the FCC as the sponsor of the non-government spectrum equities, and those things get resolved. From the time that you were in the commission, Rob, flashing forward now to the work you're doing on behalf of a real diversity of market participants, not just strict telco, but different innovators that are deploying spectrum-dependent technologies. How have you seen things change what are some of the things that Umar was referencing, the things that worked and the things that don't work? Do you have any perspective on how things have changed, that there were processes that worked better in the past and they're working now? Or are there things that, new things we should be trying? How do you see things through that lens of time?
Thank you. And it is great to be with some longtime friends. I won't use the word old. And this is quite the august group. So folks who don't know is John Neuer was the Assistant Secretary of Commerce for NTIA, which is a Senate-confirmed presidentially appointed position. So in charge of all federal spectrum coordination, basically. It's a huge job, plus other things like internet governance. But anyway, well, a lot has changed. And yes, so full disclosure, I'm at a very large international law firm called Cooley. I'm not speaking on behalf of any of our wonderful clients. But as John said, we have a diverse array of clients, everything from startups. I was taking around town last week, an amazing brand new company that's in the smart antenna space. They're going to disrupt the parabolic antenna industry by reducing the cost and shrinking by orders of magnitude those antennas. And so we can talk about some of the issues that has raised. But macro, from a macro perspective, I think, and I'm not blaming anyone, but so I don't want this to be a blame game, but many facets of government, and one could also say the private sector to a certain extent, we have reached a point now where it seems extraordinarily difficult to agree on spectrum policy and moving forward. So if we want to have policies that create abundance in spectrum, everybody can win. So under Cooper's law, our spectral efficiency doubles every 30 months, and that's great, but that still is not feeding our appetite for the use of spectrum. And you have a lot of rivalries. And when you have a scarce resource, you'll have different entities, different constituencies fighting over that scarce resource. So think of government versus the private sector is a big one, right? Government is a user of spectrum, so is the private sector. You have terrestrial versus space and satellite. So sometimes there are frictions there, which I know Jennifer could speak for years about. You have licensed versus unlicensed. And those are just a few examples of different ways we see conflict over the limited amount of spectrum that's out there. But abundance starts to make that go away. So it's got to be more than spectral efficiency. Yeah, let's say our efficiency doubles every 30 months. That's great. But let me read a couple of things, just a couple of recent studies this year. First of all, the Center for Strategic and International Studies. So for those of you who like national security, out there. I know there's at least one in the audience. The U.S. ranks 13th in the world for allocating mid-band frequencies. Now, mid-band is sort of the Goldilocks sweet spot. The signals can penetrate structures and buildings, carry a fair amount of data, and it's a nice middle ground and golden spot for spectrum. It's the most desirable right now, anyway, as the market tells us. But 12 nations rank ahead of us because our policies favor the federal government, our government, occupying 60% of mid-band, and only 5% is allocated for commercial uses. Now, that doesn't necessarily implicate satellite, but could, depending what frequencies you're using. All right, so Congress, the executive branch, private sector, it could be people like to point fingers at DOD, but it's a lot of parts of the federal government are concerned or afraid to relinquish spectrum and or don't have the right incentives to do so if they have to relocate. And so to answer your question more directly, John, since I left the FCC more than 11 years ago, which has gone by fast, by the way, we've seen this rift, growing rift, this chasm between the federal government and sort of everyone else. And then on the everyone else side, you have your own fights, as I outlined earlier, right? Your own conflicts. And so now we are in an impasse. And the impasse is the FCC's auction authority lapsed in March of last year, about a year and a half ago. And in part, that's because there's many reasons, but one of which is the reluctance or inability for the federal government to agree. You also had, and this is... again, this is not partisan at all. This is bipartisan, actually. You had the last administration not produce a national spectrum plan, although one was apparently drafted but never released, and for a variety of reasons. And this administration, as you pointed out, John, produced one that relies on studying it further, right? So we're a good decade behind. Meanwhile, ENY, formerly known as Ernst & Young, just came out with a study in June, I think it was, May or June, saying that China has built 245 5G base stations per 100,000 inhabitants. The European Union has constructed 103 per 100,000 inhabitants. And the U.S. trails badly with only 51 5G base stations per 100,000. In part, that's because of a lack of spectrum. And so that's going to drive secondary market transactions, either buying fallow spectrum or companies, and in order to buy their licenses effectively. And that has antitrust and regulatory concerns. So the hope is sooner rather than later, everyone can agree. A lot of things are put on pause because I understand we have a presidential election and both houses of Congress are up for re-election, or at least a third of the Senate is. So there's a lot of pause buttons have been hit. But Congress could fix this, and with executive branch leadership, White House leadership, we could fix this and get things moving again. Because otherwise, and I'll close with this, it takes the better part of a decade by the time you say you're going to have an auction to when that auction, that spectrum is in the hands of consumers and lit up, any kind of consumer. And so we need to get moving as a country. Otherwise, we're going to be behind both, well, Europe, Asia, and other places, both economically and from a national security perspective. And that impairs our defense industrial base, which relies on the private sector to make things and services that we need for that.
So let me,
John, you invited us to jump in when we
might.
So I love Rob's ending there, that somehow everything he said actually benefits the defense industrial base. But quite honestly, nothing there did. So I just want to go back to one data point, because I always find it interesting when we use where we rank internationally. And I'm going to use a country we often like to be in a race with, which is China. So when we talk about lower mid-band and China, a country that has, shall we say, certainly more national controls on the use of spectrum, perhaps, once allocated, once assigned, even China has restricted the use of lower 3 gigahertz to indoor use only because of their own concerns, I would imagine, with very limited outdoor use, and that is low power outdoor use. So I think what's the reason I bring this up is it's a great stat that people try to use where we rank, but what isn't looked at is what is the context for how that spectrum is actually used. And this keeps coming up when people, you know, look at things globally. It's often just looking at what does it say IMT, which is, you know, 5G internationally, or does it actually tell you what are the constraints in order to ensure coexistence by that country's national priorities? So I think that's something that often gets omitted because, let's face it, spectrum's arcane and nobody likes to really get into the weeds, but the weeds are where the economic defense and other success actually is. And I knew Amir's hand would go up, so I'll pause.
I just wanted to frame this. I was going to get, I think, where you just got to, Jennifer, but I think there is a broader dynamic at place here. And this really is what you're talking about, is this intersection between national security and economic security. And somehow it has gotten into certain branches of the government and certain members of Congress that this is a zero-sum game. And, you know, I think it was at a different FedSoc forum, and far be it from me as the former Assistant Secretary of Commerce to opine to the Defense Department. But if you surrender the economic security equation from the national security equation, you damage national security. And the reverse implies we have to address these things collaboratively. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to go back to an experience that we had during my time at NTIA, where, yes, I worked at NTIA, Rob, but I was one of hundreds of people. Believe you me, nothing would have gotten done if it was just me. But it was the 5 gigahertz band that we were looking to open for Wi-Fi. And that was heavily encumbered by the Defense Department on radar for missile interception, kind of thing, capability we kind of wanted to have. But because we were working with, I had counterparts in the Defense Department who were committed to this sort of joint collaboration. And there was also a recognition of shared equities. It really was in the interest of the Defense Department to say, if you guys are figuring out how to use the same spectrum we use for radar for communications, and it won't interfere with us, or we can manage it in a way that we can do both, being able to deliver comms and sensing in the same battlefield is something that's really of interest to the Defense Department. Innovation and growth in the private sector gives the Defense Department and the national security community capabilities they otherwise wouldn't have had. And so that was a long process, but we freed up 254 megahertz at 5 gigahertz. It's basically the foundation of 5G Wi-Fi. So, and this I'll offer to all of you now, how do we, the two sides, get that message across that this isn't zero sum, that, you know, Rob, to your point, we, you know, innovation addresses scarcity. To Jennifer, to your point, there are also some sort of immutable characteristics of physics that are required for certain, you know, highly desired national capabilities. But we have broken down the breakdown over the spectrum. Auction authority is very much a product of, if you can't auction it, you can't take it from us, and we don't want to give it up. But, you know, I think that is a problem. If, you know, if any single agency has veto authority over what should be national spectrum decisions, the decision is going to be made at the lowest possible level of that agency, right? So I'm like, that's my project. I don't want to do it. We're done. But we have to have a legal and regulatory infrastructure that has the FCC, NTIA, and the agencies pulled together to say these are all of government decisions. We can't make them in silos. So I'll open it up to all of you on any thoughts on, you know, changes that could be made to get us in that room again.
Well, I'll jump in with some thoughts and maybe building on what you were saying first, I'll say completely agree in the sense that we can't give up our commercial technology leadership and hope to maintain our military advantage. These two things are extremely intertwined. They are very connected and we need to be doing both. Before I get to that specific question, I do want to go back a little bit and just address two things that came up in the conversation about the World Radio Communication Conference and about the lower 3 gigahertz band. And I do so because I think before we jump into sort of what are the right solutions, it is important to kind of paint that picture of what is the world looking like today. And I think that, you know, first I found Jennifer's, you know, experience with the World Radio Communication Conference incredibly helpful. But I think that the dynamic in the more recent conferences has been very different. You know, the dynamic in 2019 and in 2023 was not the U.S. exporting its national decisions. Far from it. It was us going into these conferences without positions on spectrum in many cases. It was going into these conferences allowing other countries to take the lead. The dynamic in these two conferences, far from deharmonizing existing allocations, was the U.S. coming out fragmented from harmonized decisions that were made at the conference. We were coming out as a spectrum island where the rest of the world had harmonized bands. We were going in different directions. So I think more recently, you see a very different dynamic in these World Radio Communication Conferences. I was in Dubai. You know, what I saw there was a lot of countries that had a genuine interest in trying to close the digital divides in their countries. A lot of these places still struggle with mobile penetration. They were looking for spectrum to help them do that. And what I saw in Dubai was that the US did not have an answer for these countries about where they should go, but other countries did. And I think that has real consequences for our global competitiveness. with respect to sort of the lower 3 gigahertz band and what are the local versus global decisions. You know, I think China absolutely has restricted the use of that band, but they are not harmonized. That band from 3.3 to 3.45 is a harmonized band in the Americas, in Europe, in Africa, in much of the Middle East. You have over 30 countries already doing high power 5G in that band. You have the DoD accommodating those systems in that band through agreements. I think these are things that the United States can do as well. And we should be looking at how do we do these things in the United States as well. So I think that's important to sort of frame that conversation in terms of how do we start to move past this and how do we start to restore some of the trust between the agencies and the process that potentially works. You know, I think there are three things that I think the United States should really focus on doing. And the first is we do need to restore licensed auctions back into our toolbox, as Rob was saying. We have a long history of creating win-win opportunities with this tool, and that includes upgrading military systems through the special through the Spectrum Relocation Fund. It includes growing our economy, funding infrastructure projects, and a lot more. So I think we need to put that tool back in the toolbox. I think we need to reaffirm experts and science-based policymaking again. Putting incumbents who have a vested interest in the outcome in charge of spectrum studies goes against every principle of scientific study. And I don't think we have struck the right balance of that yet with the National Spectrum Strategy. I think we need to reaffirm NTI's role in that regard and reaffirm disinterested studies of spectrum. And the third thing I think is we need to reinvigorate our alliances. Accenture released a study showing that $200 billion of economic benefit is at risk if we can't work with our allies and partners to harmonize the use of our spectrum. And I think we should take advantage of that opportunity.
I think you gotta let Jennifer talk because he named her, and then I'll come in after her.
Okay, thanks, Rob.
I'm not the moderator, though, Secretary Noor. Sorry.
All right.
It's my lane, sir.
So, a couple of things. I'm going to comment on what the United States tried to do in my 30 days at the WRC in Dubai. So I had kind of a lengthy view of it. Was its priority was exporting 6 gigahertz. It wasn't MNO spectrum, but it was wireless spectrum. And that was a priority. And that is why the U.S., I would submit, though not being inside the government anymore, I can't see the decision making. It's not transparent, but I would submit that's why certain positions were not taken. So it left the United States negotiating room to preserve 6 gigahertz as unlicensed globally. And I think that the challenge we have, and because I completely agree with Umair on the science-based decision making. And it's finding that disinterested party, because when we have strategies with specific goals in them, all of a sudden you have staff that has a mindset as to what must be achieved. So it's sometimes a little hard to find out who is the most disinterested. But I think when we, you know, I'll say the non-MNO industry at least looks at some of the challenges ahead. One of the things that was valuable about the IIJA mandated paths process was it was actually the first time that there was an interactive multi-stakeholder spectrum engagement with the actual user of the spectrum who knows how they use the spectrum better than anybody else. So while DoD was only mandated to do the study, DoD on its own took the initiative to expand that to do this multi-stakeholder approach, which was not statutorily required. By most counts, and there were certainly bumps and warts along the way, but by most counts of the industries and academics that participated, it was a really good process to start. So good, it seems that NTIA and the administration are leaning into that multi-stakeholder engagement through its own national spectrum strategy and how it's approaching the lower 3 gigahertz and 7-8 gigahertz. And I view as a strength in kind of leaning into changes into spectrum governance as we're having to look at trying to figure out ways to do more with less. And that's all of us, that having not only what I like to call the general practitioner of spectrum management, whether that's the NTIA or the FCC, being a co-chair of a study, but actually having the specialist, the heart surgeon, the brain you know, surgeon, what have you, which is the actual agency that's operating in that band. They actually know how all the parts work of their systems and capabilities. Having them be co-invested as a co-chair of a study is actually an innovation in the inclusion in the outcome and participant in the outcome. So we're very supportive of this inclusive multi-stakeholder process. It's different. It's, as I said, got its warts, and it can be uncomfortable, but studies are necessary to get to an end result when you are looking to do more than just repurpose and force incumbent missions out of a band. And just as, you know, Rob was very eloquent in the sweet spot of lower 3 gig for commercial or other uses, it is a sweet spot for all technologies, not just commercial wireless, but all spectrum dependent technologies. And as a company that is looking to leverage as much commercial technology as possible, actually into solutions we provide, we understand the sweet spot of this for radar technology, whether it's hypersonic missile detection in 1 second, versus many other uses. So we just have to be cognizant of the temporal requirements as well. And again, that goes back to science and technology-based decision-making, not political decision-making. So thanks. Rob, did I tee that up for you?
Yes, but I want to make sure our moderator, Hey, Tom, okay. So a few things, and at the beginning, John talked about like my client base. So we've got startups, we have space tech, we have terrestrial mobile, we have license unlicensed, we have big tech, little tech. And sometimes there are conflicts, and I hate conflicts in private practice law. Anyway, so we have to tiptoe around that. So, but as we talk about and to build on what Jennifer just said, which is a perfect segue, the political decisions that are made, and that's not necessarily Republican versus Democrat, it's just constituencies, small p political, right? So different business constituencies or governmental constituencies. Probably if you put the four of us in a room, we could figure all this out this afternoon and get moving with some pretty good U.S. and international public policy. But throughout all this, as all those debates rage, you know, one of the things I learned at the FCC was just have faith in the engineers too. Yes, government's got to get moving. We need, Umair and I have already talked about the need for auction authority and more cooperation and collaboration between the federal government and the private sector. So NTIA, DOD, FCC, et cetera, and Congress, of course, a big part of that. But have faith in engineers. So I left the FCC in 2013. My first auction was AWS-1 in 2006. If you had told me when I was first sworn in June of 2006 that the upper teens in gigahertz would be considered mid-band, you would have had me locked up, right? So what does that mean? The brilliant engineers as policymakers, both domestically and internationally, quibble, and I don't mean to minimize the importance of any side's arguments or concerns, but things are being done in labs that we don't know about. So that's good, but that's not enough, right? So again, back to the premise I started off with at the very beginning of this, which is abundance of spectrum will help resolve a lot of these conflicts and to where everyone eats, so to speak. All constituencies can eat, and it does not have to be a zero-sum game, as John Neuer eloquently said.
So one observation I would make there is that 11, 12 gigahertz becoming mid-band is both a product of engineering and labeling success. Someone wants to take credit for mid-band spectrum, it'll be light before we go much further, right? So there were a couple of things in all of that. And I think, Jennifer, you are right that there are, you know, experts in the government who can point the way to certain things, can identify certain realities. But I think we should not underestimate the ability of the government to be misinformed, right? And this gets to the sharing of equities and having processes in place that there can be a testing of some of this information. And, you know, the multi-stakeholder model is a good one for that. But I remember when we were clearing the AWS Spectrum, Rob. And we had a survey that said from the agencies that said they came in and said, we've got X number of links that need to be relocated and it's going to cost $5 billion. And then we did a survey, like, actually, you have like 30% of those number of links. You've got old records. And that's just a database search. Now let's go back and actually touch all those radios and tell me what you have. And they came back and said, well, you know, maybe it's less than that. And the ones that we have, we can tune. So our relocation costs aren't going to be $8 billion. They're going to be $900 million. And it's not going to take 4 years. It's going to take 18 months. So it gets back to, I think, Lamar, you started on in your discussion about the processes. And, you know, I think the and again, not to be partisan, but I think the current strategy is heavy on studying without defining the terms of engagement and the processes upon which it's going to be studied, right? This spectrum, you know, has not been repurposed for the following technical reasons and the following technical conflicts. We are going to test those propositions under the following structure. But that's a bit of a moderator editorial. But I did want to get back to you, Jennifer, on part of this question and the path forward. I think this is also tied to some of Rob's talk about creating abundance. And this is the concept of sharing between services and not just an isolation in silos, but figuring out, just as we did in the 5 gigahertz experience, to allow both radars and comms to take place in the same bands under protocols that were acceptable to everyone.
Yeah, no, thanks. Thanks very much, John. Because spectrum sharing, and particularly the concept of dynamic spectrum sharing, is something where we see a real opportunity for a lot of R&D in the long run, but in the short run, even some potential to make some progress. We're looking at it through engineering, our own engineering resources, and in collaborative discussions with others in the commercial community. Under NDAs, but there, we've got to find a way to create incentives that are mutual incentives for getting to the end state of sharing by design, right? I've always liked using privacy by design and importing that concept, right? Because when you're trying to, when you're doing next generation of any technology, whether it's 6G or next generation radars, what can we all do? What can the OEMs do to provide solutions that enhance the coexistence capabilities of technologies? And because of some of the very split millisecond types of at least technologies and solutions we provide, obviously near real time, if not real time, has to be part of the equation when we look at dynamic spectrum sharing. For us, that's part of the dynamic. And using the Lockheed Martin AI Center and our team, and looking at, you know, what can we leverage from AI and ML to bring to this discussion is something that is critical in and of itself from a spectrum management perspective. But then sharing by design is also about in the manufacturing side, right? What can the different stakeholder communities bring, and which is separate apart from how can you operate differently? So, you know, it's important to understand how the MNOs want to operate this generation technology, but also next generation. It's also important to understand the various federal missions, not just their current state of technology and concept of operations, but their next generation and their generation afterwards. Because sharing and dynamic spectrum sharing, we hope, will allow for innovation across the suites of American technology, not just, I mean, I wish we had more domestic OEMs, I guess, someday with ORAN. But at least when we're talking about aviation and space and defense, we've got a lot of manufacturing here in the United States. And so we want to continue that leadership. And honestly, I guess with Samsung and a lot of the others that are investing in manufacturing, we're having a lot of OEM manufacturing here too. So that's good. But we've got to get to those incentives, and they need to be regulatory incentives or other incentives that I'm not sure we're focusing on the technology, but not the incentives yet for all the spectrum stakeholders to look at dynamic spectrum sharing as a key part of the future.
John, can I jump in there?
Yeah, sure.
So I think Jennifer's focus on incentives, I really like that. And I think another way of talking about that is making sure that what we're doing on the sharing side ultimately is economically viable. You know, we've got this 18-month dynamic spectrum sharing moonshot. I think if we spend 18 months focusing on a technology solution that ultimately isn't economically viable, we've just wasted 18 months. We have to think from the start, from the beginning, is what we're doing going to ultimately get deployed in a commercial market, and how can businesses have the assurance they need to put capital behind it. I think the biggest obstacle to these conversations, and I hear them all the time now about dynamic spectrum sharing, is that no two people seem to be talking about the same thing. And I'll give you an example. You know, when I, the sense that I have when the DoD talks about sharing, it seems like what they are framing is this idea that we have a band. We won't change anything about how we're using that band. We're not going to change anything. If the commercial sector can come in and show that they can weave in between our existing uses, and if they can show that with imperfect information, because there are some classified uses and you're not going to have that information, and if they can show that with worst case assumptions about interference, if you can do all that, then sure, we'll share it with you. But if at any point in the future we might need that spectrum back, we're going to take it back. That doesn't really sound like sharing to me. And that is not an economically viable model that I think ultimately is going to work. So I think that there needs to be a much more real discussion about what sharing actually is. At the end of the day, there is value to cleared spectrum use on both sides. Jennifer, I think, will agree with me that radar is not really a sharing technology. It's incredibly high power. It needs that. I think that when I talk to the armed services in the DoD, what I hear a lot is sort of this incremental interest in sharing. But I don't think anyone's excited about the idea of moving mission critical systems onto a sharing platform that was developed in 18 months. So I think there's still a lot of work and progress to be done, and a lot more alignment on sort of what are we even working toward.
You know, I think that raises another corollary point there, Umair, about predictability and certainty, that when decisions are made, that both sides, DOD, the federal agencies, the incumbents, industry, have confidence when a decision is made, they can then step into the space and make those investments and make those developments. I'm going to do a moderator audible here and actually turn to one of our questions, because I think it gets a little bit to that. And it's referring to the questioner is calling the C-band fiasco, where the Department of Transportation, in the 18th hour after the spectrum was being auctioned, being prepared to go to market, a single agency made comments, sort of tipped over the apple cart. And the question is asking about how we get back to regular order. And this is one of those things that I think, Rob, you made the point earlier that leadership remains important. You can have an MOU between the FCC and NTIA. You can have the Interdepartmental Radio Advisory Committee inside NTIA coordinating government views, but when people are allowed to freelance out of that process, it's massively disrupted. So, I know what would have happened if that had happened in my day. I would have gotten a very angry call from the White House. I'd have gone up to the DEPSEC's office. The DEPSEC would have called the DEPSEC of Transportation, and somebody at the Transportation Department would have had a very, very bad day. But it's hard to write that kind of process down without, so how do you, are there any confidence inspiring steps that we could consider so that participants in these sorts of proceedings don't feel the need to freelance, don't feel the need to run to, sponsors on the Hill and run an uncoordinated play?
If I can kind of jump in, I see Umair nodding his head, so I'll try to be brief uncharacteristically. So, Umair, so I want to underscore a word you just used, John, which is leadership. And this is not a partisan criticism. In fact, I will make a bipartisan compliment. If you go back into the early mid 90s, the person in charge of telecom policy, all jokes aside, was the Vice President, Al Gore, right? And that was instrumental in passing the Telecommunications Act in 1996. And I know I'm on a Federal Society call. He did not invent the internet, but he was very instrumental in passing that seminal legislation. And so you had a very senior person there in the West Wing. And I think you need to have that in any administration. It doesn't have to be the vice president, but somebody who's senior enough in the White House who can say to all of the executive branch agencies, this is a priority for us, both from a economic security position and national security perspective, to get this done. And so then we need to also work on speed, the speed of approval. And this does not have to be zero-sum game with the scientific, you know, pure science to help us making decisions versus political, which I think we all agree on. But this has to do with even things like coordination. So in space, in especially low Earth orbit, there's a lot of coordination that has to happen. The FCC has created the Space Bureau, which was applauded across the aisle. But it also needs to continue to evolve to make decisions more quickly and to streamline things as well. And perhaps take a page from what was attempted with white spaces and things like that. Its mission is to avoid harmful interference. And there are different ways to do that, especially in space, whether it's time or power level or distance, right? So there's a lot that can happen, but when you don't have very senior leadership involved at the White House level, then these fights are allowed to continue and get entrenched, get worse. And that's been a bipartisan problem.
Mark, you had a thought on that?
I think I agree with what Rob said. I think the best thing we can do is have that high level vision, have that high level goal setting about where we want to be 2 years from now. I think when you have a direction, then the agencies can work together on a whole of government approach in order to accomplish that objective. I think that's what's missing right now in the National Spectrum Strategy context. That's what I think undermines confidence that in 2 years we're going to have outcomes that potentially lead somewhere, is the lack of that vision that sort of unifies everyone.
There've been various pieces of legislation that have been proposed that have talked about upgrading the position at NTIA from an assistant secretary to an undersecretary. From my experience, I don't think that matters very much, but I do think, you know, having input in the White House, and, you know, and it can be in any number of places. It was the Office of Science and Technology Policy when I was there, different administrations. It's been, you know, the National Economic Council, OMB, but it really does take someone to prioritize and knock heads and say, we've made a decision, go forward.
That agencies participate timely in processes involving spectrum decisions. I think that the opportunities are there for that participation. I think when they participate, they have to do so meaningfully, meaning they've got to give data that is actually usable and meaningful to the decision makers that are trying to make those decisions. That means data about receiver performance. And things like that. I think that's all.
Are you referring to the FAA and the C-band?
Just thought I'd guess. Comments, general
comments. So I want to move a little bit away from the balancing of equities between the government and commercial industry and talk a little bit more about balancing equities in the commercial market participants. There is, as technology advances, spectrum that is authorized under one set of service rules can be recast to operate under a very different set of service rules, or the economic incentives and the market demand change over time. You know, the C-band was moving from one commercial use to another commercial use largely. So what are the challenges to creating, you know, an effect that allows the free flow of spectrum amongst and between commercial providers that isn't just limited to antitrust and competitive issues, but you also uncover, you know, potential windfall issues where an entity acquired a band of spectrum that had limited economic use, technology and demand has changed. They want a regulatory change of the service rules to repurpose that spectrum to a much higher economic value. You know, how do you do that in a way? Do we care about that and just say, you know, things have changed. Someone's going to make money in the large, grander scheme of things. The consumer surplus and the economic activity from putting spectrum to its higher and best use is more important. Do you guys have thoughts on that?
I'm going to kind of jump in here, maybe surprisingly, and look at this through some past decisions and kind of maybe carry it forward. The accountability of technical data being submitted to support commercial and commercial allocation decisions, I think that accountability needs to be increased. And I'm going to say, if you look at 28 gigahertz, which is just a really fun example that
comes
to mind. 28 gigahertz was a satellite, globally harmonized Ka band satellite. And the wireless industry came in and made technical submissions as to why they wanted to be able to use it for widespread outdoor deployment, dense outdoor deployment. And Intel was a major player in that discussion as well. And so the FCC decided to restrict the earth stations of Ka band systems significantly to force, if you like, co-location, as opposed to market-based decisions as to where the satellite operators could place their earth stations in order to accommodate this growth spurt in 28 gigahertz for outdoor dense use. As we know, that has not come about, and I'm not holding Umair accountable for that decision. I'm not even sure he was there then. But that was where science and technical-based decision-making wasn't in evidence. Because when you look at it today, you see why the carriers haven't done that, because that didn't make economic sense, given what we're all stuck with, which is propagation. Laws of physics and propagation, we are all stuck with this. We're trying to work our way around it in many ways. But sometimes there are finite capabilities. And making decisions based on aspirations alone versus technology capabilities is I think, a challenge we all face because we're all aspirational. But we really do need to look within a five-year radius, not a 25-year radius. And then, you know, predictability, you look at the CBRS rulemaking just announced, right? I just look at the significant high power question in that. What is predictable about a CBRS regime that was premised upon sharing in certain scenarios? And then there's a proposal to change some of the key conditions on sharing. I don't know. We're looking at it. But when you talk about predictability and changes in T's and C's, like a contract, you know, what does that say about the predictability that you said, John, was so important? I'll stop there.
So I'll maybe offer the counterexample to the 28 gigahertz band, which is C-band, right? Which is a band that was transitioned from older use to new. The speed at which that band was auctioned, deployed, and put into service in customers is astounding. The amount of investment that went into it—it's a huge success story. And so you know, agencies might not get it right 100% of the time, but there's certainly incredible success stories in terms of reallocating spectrum from old use to new. I think that, you know, I think Jennifer is pointing to two different examples. You know, for example, the 28 gigahertz band, where there's a concern about underutilization. I'm sure she would support looking at a new rulemaking in the 28 gigahertz band to look at whether the right balance was struck there. And CBRS, she seems to be opposed to that, even though there's underutilization of CBRS spectrum, as NTIA has said even in their report, and so asking questions there. So I'm not sure I understand sort of why in one instance we should be willing to relook at decisions, and in another instance we shouldn't. I think your question, John, about sort of are the frameworks in place to allow for commercial spectrum reallocation, and should we be concerned about things like windfalls and things like that? I think ultimately spectrum is like water; it wants to flow to its highest and best use, and I think regulations ultimately put up dams here and there, and we should allow it to flow to where it wants to flow. I think that there are things that we can do to help better utilization of commercial spectrum, which I think is an important thing as well in an increasingly congested environment. One thing to consider is we have this Commercial Spectrum Enhancement Act on the federal side, where we have tools available to incentivize and repurpose spectrum. Why don't we have a similar model for commercial spectrum as well? We've got sort of the emerging technologies framework that's not codified anywhere. That's something that we could look at putting into statute or law in order to streamline some of these opportunities as well, where you've got underutilized spectrum and new entrants who want to make use of it.
So I'll jump in on your behalf there for a second, Jennifer. I did not hear a distinction between you can do a rulemaking in one band and not do a rulemaking in another band. It was more of when you're going to reexamine these things, there needs to be a degree of technical rigor to support the consideration. So
yes. That was my point. Thank you very much.
I just want to point out that was moderating.
That was moderating. Real quick, I know we're over time, but real quick, I'd like for folks to kind of remember, for those who are watching, is a couple words. So certainly policies that favor abundance, that favor speed, and encourage speed and coordination. Look, there are several bills in Congress that have elements of everything we're saying to where that could be win-win. You had the House of Representatives, hardly a bipartisan bastion of cooperation, twice the House Energy and Commerce Committee in the past couple of years has unanimously reported out to spectrum auction bills. You have the Cruz bill in the Senate and the Cantwell bill, both which have some really good ideas, but there's enough in common to where they could get this done this year. I'm really pessimistic that it'll happen this year for a variety of reasons, but it could be done. But all those things, if you want to solve these problems, you have to have policies that quickly create abundance. And I think we can all agree on that, I hope.
Well, I'm going to let Rob take the last word on that. I want to thank the panelists. Very informative. It's a lot of experience represented on this Brady Bunch slide deck. And I want to thank the Federalist Society for putting it together. I think a good panel and a good day. And thanks very much. I don't know if we have any close-ups.
Great. Thanks, John. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our speakers for the benefit of their time and expertise today. Thank you also to the audience members who joined us. We greatly appreciate your participation. Check out our website, fedsoc.org, or follow us on all major social media platforms at FedSoc to stay up to date with announcements and upcoming webinars. Thank you once more for tuning in. And with that, we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.